Post-Hypnotic Press presents an unabridged recording of Jennings Again by Anthony Buckridge, narrated by Simon Vance. Chapter 1. The Aim of the Game. It is no wonder that Mr. Pemberton Oakes, headmaster of Lynbury Court School, put his foot down firmly on the subject of space invaders, and did his best to turn the attention of his boys to the more sensible topic of caring for the real world in which they lived. The matter came to a head one afternoon in October, when the pitches were too wet for football and the boys were cooped up indoors. Strolling round the school grounds during a lull between the rain showers, Mr. Pemberton Oakes was horrified to discover sweet wrappers, empty crisp packets, and discarded drink cartons blown by the wind into the long grass bordering the playing field. The headmaster held strong views about tidiness. This strewing of rubbish about the grounds was no way to treat the earth's precious store of raw materials, when people the world over were concerned with cutting down waste and protecting the atmosphere from poisonous chemicals. True, this failure to keep the school grounds free of litter was far removed from global disasters threatened by acid rain, the destruction of forests, and the pollution of rivers and oceans. Nor by themselves could the boys do much to prevent damage to the ozone layer or stem the tide of the threatened greenhouse effect. But at least they could do their best to ensure that their own little patch of the environment was kept in good shape. He would talk to the boys about this in assembly tomorrow morning, he thought. A project based on ecology would be a better way of spending their free time than this ridiculous nonsense about aliens from outer space inspired by computer games, which had become so popular during the past few weeks. However, despite the headmaster's views on the subject, the popularity of this pastime was showing no sign of abating, judging by the enthusiasm for yet another game of make-believe which, at that moment, was taking shape in the corridor outside Form 3 classroom. As usual, the organizer was Jennings, a lively 11-year-old whose plans to brighten up the routine of boarding school life so often ended in disaster.
"Derbyshire and I and some of you lot can be little green men from Mars," he announced to a group of third-formers anxious to dispel the boredom of a wet Tuesday afternoon. "You other lot can be patriotic Earthmen who've got to capture us before we hold the Earth to ransom."
"Has it got to be Mars?" complained Derbyshire,
a fair-haired, bespectacled boy whose close friendship with Jennings led him into situations from which his cautious nature shrank in alarm.
"It's always Mars when you're making up the rules. Couldn't we come from somewhere else for a change?"
"Please yourself. How about Jupiter? Or Venus, then?"
Derbyshire took off his glasses and wiped the grime from the lenses with his dirty handkerchief.
"I'd rather come from Planet X," he said.
"Planet X? Where's that?"
"Nobody really knows," Derbyshire explained. "Astronomers and those sort of people are pretty sure it's about somewhere, but it's so far away they can't quite make out where it is."
"Fair enough,"
said Venables, an untidy boy with untucked shirt and trailing shoelaces.
"You could pretend you've got superhuman intelligence, and you've come all the way from Planet X to tell the astronomer geezers where to look."
Atkinson giggled.
"Superhuman intelligence? Derbyshire?"
Derbyshire ignored the insult.
"And we could say we've come all this way to bring peace and goodwill and all that flannel, and show people how to stop the Earth getting too hot."
This didn't satisfy the burly, square-rigged Temple.
"That's crazy. Planet dwellers are always evil enemy aliens. They're not supposed to be friendly."
Jennings, as organizer, settled the argument.
"We'll do it both ways. First, you think you've come to destroy the world, so you have to take us prisoner. Then, just as you're going to wipe us out with your laser beams, we turn round and tell you how to bung up the hole in the ozone layer."
"Okay," Derbyshire agreed. "So by the end of the game, we all finish up being Mr. Nice Guys."
That settled, Jennings divided the players into planet dwellers and Earthmen.
"We split up alphabetically," he announced. "All blokes whose names start with A to M are Planet X's. If you're an N to Z, you're an Earthman."
For the next 20 minutes the corridors echoed to the clatter of juvenile footwear and the squawking of juvenile vocal cords as defenders and attackers chased one another round the building. The rules of the game were simple, and the basic aim was clear. The ground floor was Earth, the upper stories outer space. On their home ground, the attackers were free from arrest, but once they set foot on Earth, they were at the mercy of any defender nimble enough to catch them or wily enough to lure them into some crafty ambush.
For, as well as avoiding arrest, the spacemen's task was to seize and make off with the geographical globe, normally kept in Form 3 classroom. The globe, slightly larger than a football, was marked with lines of latitude and longitude and showed the physical features of the world in various colours. Whichever side held this trophy in its possession held the world in its power. It was, perhaps, a somewhat fanciful idea, but good enough to fire the imagination of both defenders and attackers. Derbyshire crouched behind a laundry basket on the first floor landing, peering down through the banisters at the open door of Form 3 classroom on the floor below. In his imagination, he was circling the Earth in his spaceship looking for a suitable place to land. He had just arrived from Planet X in the outer reaches of the galaxy. Here on the landing, he was safe. The Earthmen couldn't reach him high up beyond the ozone layer. And what should his mission be when he landed on Earth? Let's think now. He would be a creature of fantastic intelligence, he told himself, who had come to teach the top scientists of the world, who would listen, open-mouthed and goggle-eyed with wonder, as he explained in simple language the mysteries of the universe. "Don't blame yourselves if you find it hard to understand," he would tell the astronomers and the professors of astrophysics in his opening lecture. "We on Planet X have developed our brain power to a far greater degree than you human beings are capable of. In fact, we can even—" The lecture was cut short by Jennings racing along the landing and skidding to a halt beside the laundry basket. "Hey, Darby, we can capture the trophy if we go right away," he said. "Venables has just gone rushing off after Bromwich and Martin Jones, and there's only Rumbelow left on guard. If we can get rid of him, we'll be laughing." Jennings's plan seemed feasible. The globe was clearly visible through the open classroom door. It would be the work of only a few moments to slide down the banisters, dart into the classroom, grab the trophy and rush back upstairs to the safety of the first floor landing. "But how can we go downstairs with Rumbelow on the lookout?" Derbyshire demurred. "He's only got to slap you on the shoulder and you're his prisoner."
"We'll create a diversion," Jennings explained. "I'll go first and make a noise so he sees me. I'll be a sort of decoy duck to lead him astray. Then I'll belt off to the changing room and he'll come rushing after me. That's when you slip into the classroom like greased lightning and grab the globe."
Derbyshire didn't think much of his part in the plan. He disliked all forms of violent activity and was much happier in his role of the superintelligent being revealing the secrets of the universe to the astronomers and physicists with their sadly limited human brain power.
"It's all very well to say slip in and grab it, but it's on that shelf by the window, and I can't reach it without a chair or something to stand on. Supposing Venables comes back while I'm still trying to get it down? Supposing—"
"Oh, for goodness sake," stormed Jennings. "You're about as much use as an oil-fired gumboot. You'll just have to be quick, that's all."
"Can't we do it the other way round? I'll be the decoy duck, or whatever you call it, and you can pinch the globe. Anyway, you're taller than me, so you ought to be able to reach it without standing on a chair."
This might well be the better plan, Jennings reasoned. Derbyshire was his best friend and a loyal follower, but Jennings had to admit that he was pretty useless as a man of action. Of all the many exploits in and out of school in which the pair had been involved, it was always Jennings who took the initiative, and Derbyshire who followed behind, doing his best to restrain his leader from the disastrous results of his actions.
"Okay, then, you be the decoy duck, and I'll follow as soon as you and Rumbelow are out of sight."
Even if Derbyshire was captured, he wouldn't be much loss to his side, Jennings thought. With great caution, Derbyshire tiptoed down the stairs to the hall. Rumbelow, though close at hand, was looking the other way and didn't see him.
"Ahem, ahem,"
said the decoy duck and flapped his arms. The guard turned and saw him and gave chase. Derbyshire was no athlete and, despite a 10-yard start, was soon losing ground as Rumbelow pounded along in his wake. The capture took place outside the boot room in the basement, after which Derbyshire was escorted to the prisoner's bench in the changing room, where other captives were waiting until the end of the game, or until, by some lucky chance, they were rescued by one of their own side. Bromwich and Martin Jones, captured by Venables and now guarded by Pettigrew, were already seated when Derbyshire was ushered in.
"Bad luck, Darby," Bromwich greeted him. "What happened?" "I was a decoy duck," said Derbyshire. "I volunteered to invade enemy territory alone and unaided, with no hope of rescue if the worst came to the worst."
He smiled modestly.
"It was what you might call a heroic sacrifice in a hopeless cause."
His fellow prisoners winked at each other and grinned. Nobody had much faith in Derbyshire as a hero of daring exploits.